Today on the Hadean podcast, we are very happy to present Carl Nordblom, author of Historiola, The Power of Narrative Charms. In this episode, Carl and I discuss the meaning and history of this ancient and powerful technique, which has deep roots within the magical practices of cultures from all over the world, as well as the phenomenological applications and implications of its use. We explore the manner in which these narrative charms are spoken, their use as both medicinal aids as well as the nature of their internal structures and geographies. We speculate on the nature of their power, the magical voice, and debate the nature of the mythic as opposed to the mystical, the nature of time and the immanent practicality of the virtues from which they are constructed. I am your host, Matt Hadfield, and it is with great pleasure that I welcome Carl Nordblom to the Hadean Press podcast.
Hi, Carl. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Matt. Good to be here today.
Carl, could you introduce yourself and your background, maybe something of your tradition?
Yeah. So my name is Carl Nordblom, and I am Swedish to begin with, but I currently live in the UK since maybe 7 years back. On a day-to-day level, I work in an esoteric bookshop in London, but I'm also the author of this book, Historiola, The Power of the Narrative Charms, which has been published by Hadean. I'm mainly involved in sort of the tradition of traditional Scandinavian Norse folk magic, which is commonly referred to as trolldom. And I've been a long-term student and apprentice of a guy called Johannes Gårdbäck, who's a Swedish gentleman who has very much sort of collected and transmitted this traditional form of folk magic into the modern period, you could say. He has brought out many of these kind of courses, and he's keeping the tradition quite active at the moment and has a lot of students and so on. But I've been lucky enough to have been an apprentice with him, and I'm currently also working sort of part-time professionally as a as practitioner within that fold, you could say. And so that's sort of my background.
So could you maybe for our listeners explain something a little bit about what trolldom actually is? What does it entail? What distinguishes it from other branches of magical practice?
Yeah, that's a good question. I suppose when you're in a tradition, you don't think about it, these things that much, really. I guess all types of magical practice, magical culture, is informed by their locality, is formed by the place and the time and the context and the nature and so on and so forth in which they are practiced. And the uniqueness, I suppose, of the what we call the trolldom tradition is that it is highly informed by Scandinavian nature, by Scandinavian culture, by the things that people have needed and sought out and communicated and been in relationality with within nature, among the farms and so on and so forth. So it has that flavor, which comes about by being in relationship with the land, with the spirits, with the wants and needs, and maybe sometimes the problems that come up in those kind of situations. I think it has a lot of the same kind of methods in many ways that you can find in North European folk magic, even South European folk magic, and so on. But it definitely has a specific kind of flavor, and that is highly informed by its context. It's difficult for me to say, really, but yeah, it's a unique thing, and it's still alive as well. So it's of course, when we practice it, we look back in history and we see what people have done before, and we sort of read some of the text and so on, a little bit like recipe books sometimes. But at the same time, the ingredients are still warm, if you want to use that metaphor. A lot of the practices are still practiced, even by common folk, you know. And there's also a long tradition of charmers and of folk healers and so on, that of course have sort of maybe waned a little bit over the last 100 years, but there's still people out there who are keeping the tradition alive.
So today we are exploring your text, Historiola, The Power of Narrative Charms, published by Hadean Press in 2021. I think this work has made a really big impression in a quiet way. And I think it's really influenced the wider occult community significantly. Could you briefly describe something of the premise of your book?
I'm really impressed that you're saying that it's influenced the wider occult community in a significant way. That's beyond me. I'm really curious to hear how that might have happened, really. I'm very happy to hear if it has done some kind of imprint, at least. But yeah, I mean, the main premise of the book is actually that through this tradition that I practice, we have these so-called troll formulas, when we use the word troll formulas, for instance, and we use the word trolldom, it signifies basically what you could perhaps call magic in general. So a troll formula is basically a magical formula. Anything related with a troll in front of it in a word usually means sort of something related to magic. Just to have that said. So when people see things like words like, I don't know, troll man or troll woman or troll cat or what have you, troll drum is like a shaman's drum, for instance, in Swedish. Troll staff is a wand, and so on and so forth. So just to have that clear. These troll formulas are many times these kind of narrative charms, and I started practicing them and got very good results with them practically, and I got really curious about the history behind them, and I started to research a little bit and found a lot of scholarly work on it. And I found that they were quite universal, something that you find in many different cultures, in many different types, and also that they're quite ancient, something I didn't know before. They have a long, long history. And something that struck me when reading a lot of academic work was that I didn't find the way they were describing the practice of these charms that compelling, really. They usually used kind of modern philosophical linguistic interpretations, which I found a little bit lacking. And I was compelled to write something that came more from a practitioner's point of view. But also exploring maybe the phenomenological aspects of these charms. So that's sort of the main premise. I think also that so it's kind of an exploration of these this type of incantations that are called today historiola, narrative charms. But it's also one of the main premises of it is to explore a different kind of way of thinking about magic that you don't really see that often, which is phenomenological in one sense, and is rooted in practice, but also kind of a critique in a way of presumed ideas around what you could call sympathetic magic, I suppose. So it's a way for me to express how I think that many contemporary scholarly theories surrounding these things are problematic, you could say.
I see. And so what exactly is the definition of a historiola?
I think the main definition of the historiola is a brief narrative charm, basically, as a short story that has a magical function in one way or another. So it's constructed like a narrative. It's usually in a past sense. So it's like a, could be a happening where an entity, maybe a harmful being, a demon of sorts, is going towards a someone's house, and it's warded off by another powerful entity, maybe a saint or something similar to that. So you recite it, or it's written down or whatever. So it's in the form of narrative simply, and it's quite short. It's usually never like a book length or anything like that. So it's usually just a few sentences long, and it's used in a practical context. So it's not theoretical or open for a sort of interpretation level that is just for entertainment or anything like that. It's rather something that's directly practical. Yeah.
And you mentioned in the book, I think, about how the historiola itself, or the narrative charm itself, can be spoken aloud, or it can be spoken with clenched teeth. Could you perhaps discuss a little about the manner in which one delivers such a narrative charm?
Yeah, I think that varies quite a bit, actually. Recently, I've become quite interested in Finnish charms, and they're mainly sung. So they have a long tradition of singing these charms. They're a bit longer, actually. And they're really beautiful as well, and quite elaborate. And I think the same thing goes actually for North Scandinavian sort of Sami tradition. I might have to research that a little bit more actually before I make statements. But it definitely varies. Traditionally, we in the sort of South Scandinavian tradition, we would either sort of mutter them, or we would do them with clenched teeth. And the sort of rationale behind that is that we're not supposed to reveal them, really. They should be spoken in silence, because as soon as they're transmitted or heard by someone else, really, they sort of lose their power. So you have to keep them quiet for yourself, and then it's more like you would read them out with your teeth clenched, so that you could sort of contain the incantation within your mouth, and then you would sort of use the air that's contained within the mouth and maybe blow it on the target or a client, or maybe some water or something, a liquid to use, and so on. Personally, I more do it kind of in a whisper, personally. And I'm sure there are quite a few people that also do it just straight out loud, but maybe then they don't have other people around them, for instance. So I think there is quite a nuanced way, as in people use them in different kind of ways. It depends a little bit on the tradition, maybe, also maybe the what different people prefer themselves. So yeah, it varies definitely.
And so we're really talking about language itself as a medium through which magic can be effectuated, or would you disagree with that, or how would you define that? How would you describe that?
Yeah, this is really interesting, I suppose. This is where it gets both complicated but also interesting. I suppose that anything in many ways can be used in a quote-unquote magical manner. I mean, as I try to describe in a book, we're talking about nuances and applications of power in a way, of force or whatever, or energy or what have you, some kind of occulted dynamic force in one way or another. And what magical practices usually do is to utilize various modes of power in one way or another, I guess. And I guess language is such a universal thing, and it's such a powerful thing, that humans since, I guess, the dawn of time have been making use of it in one way or another. And many different, I guess, occult philosophies, lack of better terminology, or mystical traditions, have developed certain quite elaborate forms of theoreticizing concerning these things. I mean, you have, for instance, Kabbalah, which is quite elaborate, as well as certain Indian philosophies, where you have a certain form of letterism involved, where language or words or letters or what have you are seen as almost like primordial metaphysical realities and so on. But I don't think that is sort of needed when discussing these narrative charms, really. You don't have to go into that sort of territory, really, although those things are very, very interesting, and I personally think they're extremely interesting. But I think we can just make it as easy as saying that within a magical context, whatever that means, we're discussing applied dynamic power in one way or another, and language is just one way of dealing with that. Yeah, does that answer your question?
Yes, it was pretty good. Yeah, you mentioned mysticism, but when we're talking about these narrative charms, we're not really talking about mystical experiences. It's more about how one interfaces or accesses mythic narrative in a magical context. Could you describe what you mean by the mythic when engaging with a historiola? And what do you mean when you say that these narratives exist in mythical time or out of time?
Within the book, I believe I use the word mythic in more of a broader general sense. That's sort of commonsensical in a way. But I guess that there are a couple of different ways of understanding what myth means, and it has been explored sort of over the last couple of hundred years in Western academia, and that's usually that myths are speaking about natural occurrences, or their stories about things happening in a very remote past. So they're kind of legendary things that are happening, or also sort of creation stories or whatnot. And then there's yet another kind of form of interpretation, which is a more of a transcendental type of interpretation, I suppose, where you have people like Eliade or Joseph Campbell speaking about myths as conveying perhaps a transcendental truth, or they speak about archetypical realities or something like that. But both those types of interpretation are, or theories concerning myths rather, are about interpretation. They're about analysis of myth. And I'm not sure if those really apply to these historiola, really. Because the historiola, as I said earlier, are not really about entertainment. They're not really stories as such. They're more methods of how to move about and utilize power for specific aims and so on. So it's quite a different thing altogether, I have to say. And concerning time, that's really interesting, a very interesting kind of thing. And I try my best to rather speak about maybe the imminent aspects of the these charms, these narratives, rather than the transcendental aspects of them. Because you can understand perhaps things on a timeline, as in an idea of linear time, where you have something happening in a remote past, and that perhaps says something or informs us of something in our current day or whatever. That's quite an odd way of looking at a time, I think, and it sounds to me more like a fabrication. And I do wonder if anyone ever has actually understood time like that. I think that folks in all ages and cultures have more either related to time more as a cluster, perhaps, of the past and the present and maybe the future being available to them all the time, sort of overlaying each other, or maybe more related to it through an aspect of cyclical time, or perhaps time as a movement that goes sort of that manifests and then disintegrates or something like that, as in kind of a wave or whatever. This goes into sort of deep territory about like the philosophy of time, I guess. But what I'm trying to say is that I don't think it's necessary to talk about the narratives expressed in the narrative charms as something either transcendental or taking place in a long, long distant remote past, but rather what's really interesting about them is their imminent aspects, that they relate to something, or they are perceived of as taking place here and now, not in some place beyond time or outside of time or in a timeline way back or whatever. Yeah.
And to that point, you also mentioned this notion that each historiola possesses a internal geography and a locality. And could you elaborate on that further?
I think that's something that's that mainly came up to me when approaching these practically, or for my own sort of practice, but also it really expresses and more my idea of exploring them from this kind of phenomenological lens of what happens when we actually perceive the narratives in a direct manner. So when we investigate them personally, what actually happens within the narratives, how can we visualize them? And I think it's quite important to be able, at least when we begin exploring these narratives, to get a sense, both visually below, but also perhaps through other sort of cognitive senses, of what is going on within them. So we can internalize them and then externalize them by use. So you see in the narratives almost always figures and shapes and happenings and movement and so on. And those things are the most important things, I think. It's like what actually happens in the narrative, and not in an abstract sense, not in like from, I guess when you look at them just purely as a script, as text, then it's kind of problematic to make sense of them. So what you want to do is you want to actually see the landscape around you, then you sort of make them more real, you know, then you make them more accessible to you, and you can move through them as the narrative unfolds, and you see what happens, you see, you feel what happens within them in a different kind of way, almost like a film, you know, but as something that actually happens. So you use your internal imagination, you could say, to produce a true and real movement of that you can then utilize within a particular kind of setting, you know.
So you mention in the book there are specific instances where, for instance, if in specific Historiola, when one meets a demon, it's usually on a road and it's moving from one location to another. It's moving past the patient or the person who is suffering from the issue. Engaging in the geography of that, the landscape of the Historiola, the very recitation of it creates this environment where the demon itself finds itself on a road. How else could you describe that process, engaging into that process or accessing that?
Well, what we have there is we want to make things accessible to us. As human beings, we need to have frameworks to use so that we can make changes, you know, so we can have things happening. So we use language and we use imagery or our senses to familiarize and actually have points of interaction with the universe around us or whatever. And the narratives allow us to do these things, you know, in a very concrete way. So, for instance, I think something really, really interesting going on within banishings, for instance, within these Historiola, it's a very kind of common trope in the Scandinavian narrative charms, is that you banish evil spirits or personifications of illnesses or maybe the evil eye or what have you. Envy is a common thing, or anything bad, to a remote location. It's usually like a mountain where no one lives on, or a river where no one has a boat, or things like that. And if you want to understand what that means, it's one way to just say these things, but it's another thing to actually understand where those places sort of are in a psychic geography, you could say. Mm-hmm. Like, where actually are those places located? I know the Norwegians always say like Dovrefjell, that's like a mountain range really, really far up north in Norway, where they think that giants and trolls and such live. And that's an actual location, you know, But it's also, in one way, kind of a vague location, maybe for people living in Sweden that still would have used these charms or whatever. So you have to sort of get it into your mind where those places are. So maybe it's worth for practitioners to actually sit around and go on a little psychic quest to these locations. How do they look like, and how do they feel like, and how do you get there, and how do you not get back, so to speak? So you have that all framed out, because that's where you're sending things, and you don't want them to return. There's other types of localities that are used within the book. They're almost like a causal chain, so you move things through branches, through leaves, and so on. And I find it really, really interesting how people have constructed these narratives using these tropes, you could say. And it talks a lot about what they found useful, these people that constructed them, I think. But also, I think it points out how we, as practitioners these days, can figure them out a little bit practically, and start making use of them. Maybe
discussing the mountains far, far away. That's interesting to me, for because I think it is Mount Ararat. Is one of these mystical mountains far away where Noah's Ark landed, but you find it on the old world maps that were created by the Babylonians or the Mesopotamians. It's this really interesting similarity in a way. I thought that was pretty interesting. What kinds of people were using Historiola throughout history?
Anyone could use them. It might be a case where it's someone learn a little charm from their grandfather or grandmother, and they sort of just knew what kind of setting that it would traditionally been used for, so they kept on doing it. Some people, I suppose, were what scholars these days like to call ritual specialists. People in specific cultural contexts that have this as a profession or a semi-profession. In England, I know that like a common kind of name for certain kind of cunning folk, or whatever you want to call them, is a charmer. So I would guess some of those folks had maybe a few charms, or maybe one charm that they have tried and tested. But I think it's most probably both people who would be either sort of specialists or semi-specialists or just common folk that use them. Yeah.
So this wasn't the sole domain of people practicing medicine or specifically, like as you said, ritual specialists. This was is accessible to anybody.
Yeah. I mean, that goes into the whole thing about who was a medical specialist and who wasn't back in the day, I guess. Some people have always been. But in a day-to-day setting, we all need to be able to put on a Band-Aid or a plaster or know how to do certain like basic medical treatments, you know. So I think common folk would have known how to maybe had like one charm or whatever. Maybe a ritual specialist had a few more. It's difficult to say, really. But yeah, I think that they were spread. As there are so many of them and they're so universal, I suppose that it's been something that's passed both among the more learned classes as well as the more common folk or whatever you want to call it.
I ask because there are a lot of instances where the historiola are used for headaches, toothaches, or even in one instance, helping to cure piles. So there seems to be a lot of medical applications for them. Could you give us an example of another historiola which doesn't focus on medical, like a medical need?
I suppose the reason why you find it applied to so many medical needs is because what we these days call magic, I suppose, it has been so highly linked to healing, to medicine. This is what people have needed, quote unquote, magic for, you know. It's a form of healing art, you know, in many ways. But I guess one narrative charm that I mention in the book that's quite interesting, actually, is one that I found in the PGM. That's kind of this slightly aggressive Jewish love spell, which I found really interesting, where the practitioner calls on the fire and brimstone that came down on Sodom and Gomorrah. And that's that's quite something when you read it. It's a very aggressive love spell. And yeah, that's an interesting instance where you use the historiola for some other kind of means. It's more of an like the historiola that you find that are dealing more with taking away bad things and so on. It's more about, yeah, exactly, taking away something. It's more about removing something, an exorcism of sorts. So the movement of the historiola, the narrative, functions more as a way of, yeah, taking away bad things. But here is more a matter of an amplification, you know, bringing on something, which is really interesting. So
another example in your book is a very short historiola about a wolf being finding food and drinking water, and that's it. It's very simple. It's just the wolf ate some food and drank some water. Despite its brevity, it's entirely about action. It's entirely about movement, and it's about, I guess, bringing sustenance or bringing those like basic necessities of food and water to the individual reciting the historiola.
Yeah, I think I used that one as a particular example of the idea of how to analyze the sort of internal logic of the historiola, that actually what we are mainly interested in when using these is to make a certain kind of force accessible to us, or a certain kind of movement accessible to us, which we then can apply in a certain circumstance. So I think one way of looking at that particular example with the wolf is that we want to, because what it has been used for is to help out with digestion. So what we actually are aiming to evoke in a way, or make accessible to us, is this digestive process of the wolf, that wolves are somehow able to eat a lot of things and digest them very well. So what we're actually trying to call on here to make possible is this same power that the wolf has to digest, and then we transfer that to a client, to a person in need of that same force, you could say.
So you mentioned that there is a high sense of inventiveness and creativity that went into the construction of these charms. Could you describe what these elements are and what makes a successful charm?
I think anything can be a successful charm, really. That's the thing. Like, nature, the universe is just full of potentialities when it comes to these things, and that's something that I've been so impressed by looking at many different charms, many different narratives, is this sort of in fantastic way in which people have been so extremely precise in what sort of imagery they're using. One very simple thing that I found in a charm, I'm not certain, I can't remember exactly which one it is in the book now, but it just ends with the line lock and key. I thought to myself when reading that how absolutely incredible just such a short strophe is actually when looking into what it means, you know, when what does it feel to put in a key in a lock and turn it, you know, that is a finalization of something. But it's you seal something up, you make it complete, you stop something, you're able to bind something, contain it, so that it's made stable, clear, real. And when you actually think about the historiola and charms and incantations in this general sense, that it's actually not just abstract language, it tries to point you, your mind, into a certain direction, then these narratives start to unravel in a very different way. They become, you know, lived realities in a not just like purely fantastical way, but in a very concrete way. And that's what's so interesting about them. Usually, so many of them uses these not actually mythical things, but very concrete natural occurrences. And that, I think, speaks a lot about what people related to, what they found not fantastical, again, but actually conveying a direct truth, and how you can use direct truths to a certain situation. That's something that's been really interesting whilst researching the book. You know.
So we mentioned before we started recording a little an idea that I'd been thinking about, which was this idea that the historiola themselves are, because of the repetition throughout history of their use, they're repositories, not just repositories of power, but perhaps also maybe they are possessed of spirit. And perhaps we could say in some regard, in some way, that the recitation of these historiola is the conjuration of that spirit. What do you think about that?
Yeah, absolutely. That is definitely the rationale behind this idea that you shouldn't speak them out loud, for instance. Or you can speak them out loud, but not so other people hear them. Because then the spirit sort of passes away from them, maybe. And that's also the rationale behind why I think that people might not want to just sort of construct their own historiola always, but maybe find them in their own tradition, preferably living tradition, in the in a sort of traditional folk magic of Scandinavia. It's usually said that you have to have these historiola transmitted to you in certain circumstances, under certain ritualized forms and so on. I mean, that's not always necessary, but I think that just having some kind of respect for them and perhaps understanding that they are loaded or charged, perhaps that at least makes you more prone to see them as you say, like they are carriers of power, and usually what you might want to do is to try and find something from your own language. There are so many of them in so many different languages. It might be useful for you to pick one up that you can actually recite in your native tongue. I think that's quite useful, because then you get that link to your perhaps ancestral spirits and so on. But it also makes it easier for you to access. And definitely that's, if they have been recited over a long period of time, then there does exist something there that is sort of an underlying aspect. But of course, you need to practice them yourself. Like, it doesn't come for free either. You have to sort of imbue them yourself or investigate them yourself to help that out, you know. Definitely. I think it may be a combination of the two. Maybe that's there's a seed in them that that you can access, but you have to sort of water it and nourish it yourself with your own practice. Yeah,
I love that analogy. That's really wonderful. So, Carl, what do you hope readers of your book will be able to take away?
Yeah, that's a good question. hopefully it. Maybe opens them up to vistas of magical practice that they haven't been familiar with before. I think it's kind of an understudied area. People usually talk about folk magical practices, if you want to call these folk magical practices, through more historical perspectives. I'm not really an historian, so I prefer to speak about them as how I experience them here and now, you know. And I think it maybe also will be interesting for people to look at the ideas of language and words of power and so on from these perspectives that I lay out. Yeah, and hopefully, actually, it might spur some interest in charms and incantations from people's own traditions, and you can see maybe a revitalization of these practices in other cultures, not just Scandinavian folk magic or whatever. But I mean, there's such a huge variety of these charms that it would be fantastic to see or hear from people who have started to make use of them in their own native traditions.
Excellent. And finally, what are you most interested in or obsessed with at the moment? Is there anything you'd like to share, maybe an upcoming project or something that you're researching at the moment?
Actually, my main interest is actually in sort of Indian philosophy. Which might sound strange to some people, as I've been writing this book about Scandinavian folk magic or whatever. So my main sort of interest is actually in like meditation and such. But that's something that I have no interest of writing anything on, because it's I'm not really. I don't really have the skills to write anything good on any of those topics, really. But there's one sort of practice, another practice, you can say, in traditional trolldom that I've sort of become very interested in, and I think is very understudied from a contemporary practitioner's point of view. That I might write something about if I get the time. But I'm not going to tell too much about that because it's still just sort of ideas that I have. But hopefully, if the gods are good to me, then they will bless me with some time, and hopefully you can see something being published in some type of future. Yeah.
And where can our listeners find you online?
I don't really have a presence as such. I have a Facebook page, but I mainly use it for work. I have a page on the rootdoctor.se. That's Johannes Gårdbeck's page, where we offer sort of help to clients within this field of sort of folk healing and folk magic. That's not really anything related to this work as an author of this book, but it's more like we're actually doing more traditional folk healing for folks. So, but yeah, if people are interested in that, they can find me there as well.
Well, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast, Carl. It was an absolute pleasure talking with you.
Likewise. Thank you very much for having me. Thank you.
That was Carl Nolblum discussing his book, Historiola, The Power of Narrative Charms, published by Hadean Press. Since I became aware of Historiola in academic papers and then reading Carl's book in August of last year, I have become increasingly interested in exploring this subject in my own practice and have begun noticing examples of these narrative charms dotted throughout the texts of the PGM, as well as potential examples from the grimoire tradition. Becoming conscious of when they are being applied and exploring their internal geographies opens up an entirely new dimension to our modern practice, which I find fascinating. Despite their simple brevity and unassuming nature, they possess great repositories of power which connect us with myth, our ancestors, and the spirits which reside within their landscapes. I can't recommend his book enough as a concise introduction to their history theory and application. For those interested in learning more about Carl, a link to his page on the Root Doctor website can be found in the description below. We are still very close to hitting our goal of 1,000 subscribers, so please like this video and subscribe to the channel for more podcasts and book trailers in the future. Share our videos with your friends and those you think will enjoy our content on magic and the occult. Finally, if you haven't already, please check out our trailer for Night School Volume 2 by Jake Stratton Kent, which is currently in pre-order. You'll find it tagged in the video recommendation above. As with all of his work, it is sure to be a game changer. I hope you all had a fantastic new year, and I look forward to seeing you all again in the next one.